It's supposed to remind you to make sure you have all noisemakers, cell phones, and pagers turned off before we start the session. Okay, and I want to tell you a little bit about this session. The session came about when I was reading the This I Believe book, published as a collection of NPR essays that have been read on the air. And as I was reading it, I thought it would make a great Sunstone session, that I'd love to see my fellow Sunstonians share very briefly. I'm just saying they didn't quite count the words, but they tried to be close. And so I emailed Dan Witherspoon and said, way past the deadline, and said, I think this would be a great session for next year. And then 2 weeks later, Mary Ellen emailed me back and said, we had a session canceled. We're going to go for it this year. Would you like to moderate? I said, okay, as long as moderating doesn't mean finding the people that are going to be speaking. She said, no, I'll do that. So I'm here moderating. In the front of the book and online, the NPR editors describe that this was a 1950 series, and then they write these essays. And hands down, they said it's a very difficult essay to write, to keep it this short. And they give a few suggestions, which I had on a handout that some of you got, on how to do this. Number one is tell a story. Be specific, ground your beliefs in the events of your life. Consider moments when your belief was formed. Be brief, 350 to 500 words. And I can tell you, when I was reading the book, I had to put it down because they're so powerful, some of these, that I had to stop in between. If you can't name it in a sentence or two, you might not be talking about belief. And consider focusing on just one belief. Be positive. Say what you do believe, not what you don't believe. Avoid statements of religious dogma, preaching, or editorializing. And number five, be personal. Use the I voice, not the subtly sermonizing we voice. Someone that was asked to be on this panel but wasn't able to attend this year was a creative writing professor who responded, I assign this every year, and some of my best students biff it because it's so hard. Something that is difficult to try and boil a core belief down into a very short description. So I'm going to introduce our panel today. The first person on our panel will be Stephen Carter, who's the illustrious new editor of Sunstone that we're looking forward to hearing and seeing the shape that Sunstone takes under his direction. And he gave us a preview last night of his first column editor's column, and he'll be sharing some of that with us today as part of his This I Believe. Our second presenter is currently the chair of Dialogue's Board of Directors. She published an article several years ago called Where Have All the Women Gone? That was quite poignant and touching. She currently teaches Relief Society and Teacher Development in Seattle. David Pace, next, is a stage critic for 10 years, and currently a grant writer for the Ryrie Woodbury Dance Company, and he's from Provo, Utah. Following David is Jody England Hansen. She's a mixed media artist who looks like she's Bratzlin. She did was published in Sunstone an article called Creating Faith, the Conditions of Existence. She's also given several energetic devotionals that I've heard in past years here at Sunstone. Samuel Erickson has published several plays in... Eric Samuelson, I'm sorry. A little flustered being ready here today. Eric Samuelson is done. Holly Welker has a PhD in contemporary American literary nonfiction, and she currently teaches literature. She's published poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. And 2 years ago, she organized a panel on straight women who've had relationships with gay men, and it was the most heart-wrenching Sunstone session I've ever attended. Next, after Holly, will be Michael Collister. We are married and together have 4 children. We published an article in Sunstone 2 years ago called For Better, For Worse, For Apostasy, How Faith Relationships Affect Couple Relationships. And Michael has a gift of humor that he uses regularly to dream and at home when things get tense, and in Sunday school, which some people might view as distracting and others as a nice relief from too much religious dogma. Following Michael will be Christine Hagman. She lives near Boston with three children who are theologically sophisticated enough to prize the doctrine of free agency over the lesser commandment to honor their mother, when she's not trying to persuade them to bathe, eat vegetables, and otherwise act civilized, or screaming dire threats. She reads omnivorously, cooks herbivorously, and cleans dilatorily. Not really. And she's also the new editor of Dialogue magazine. John Remy passes as an IT professional by day and a father and husband by night. He's been called at various times a post-Mormon, feminist, an atheist Quaker, and a confused tea junkie. He is frequently cited and sometimes berated at mindonfire.com. This is our panel. We're looking forward to an interesting next hour, and depending on how long this takes, we want you to be thinking about your own essay that you would write on this, I believe. So keep that in mind, and if we've got time, we'll pass out some paper and let you start writing. Stephen.
You're just going to sort of pin it to yourself, but you will be forever famous on YouTube. Okay, just to let you know, I did not know how to write a This I Believe essay before I wrote my This I Believe essay, so we'll see what happens. I believe, this is going to sound silly, I believe in sunstone. Let me tell you why. Oh, this is totally in the way. I first met Eugene England in 1997. Yes. No, I'm fine. Thank you, though. He had just taken a position as a writer-in-residence at Utah Valley State College, and he was in the initial stages of planning what is now the Mormon Studies program. By some stroke of luck, I got hired as his administrative assistant, and I became deeply involved in his work. I got to sit in on both private and public scholarly symposia with some of the most interesting people in Mormon studies, such as the late Dean Mays. As you might imagine, this was a pretty formative time for me, not least because, for the first time in my life, I heard Mormonism discussed with discipline, intelligence, and spirit. I realized only later, though, how unique my time with Gene was. Few discourse has carried on with such skill and wisdom. I attribute the unique spirit of these meetings to Gene's commitment to Joseph Smith's concept of proving contraries. Now, when one proves contraries, Gene argued, you're not doing so to identify which one is right and which one is wrong, but to experience the tension between them. It is in the experience of dwelling in this tension that makes you wiser. So later during graduate school, I became fascinated with the structure of stories, because I discovered that the great characters of fiction are those who are stretched between two competing values. Think of Asher Lev, stretched between his devotion to his religion and his passion for art. Or think of The Merchant of Venice, where justice and mercy vie for the souls of Shylock and Portia. I also learned that the great stories of the world have second acts. Now, this might seem like a silly thing to say, but so many stories set up a problem, which is the job of the first act, and then resolve it, which is the job of the third act, with little to no struggle in between. That makes a story great, because that's the time when the opposing forces are at their most powerful. It's when they wreak their full havoc on the character. Rest assured that any character that makes it through the second act without a scar is cheating. I began to see that Gene was right. Those who dwell in the tension, those who are willing to go through their second act, gain much. Those who jump out too early, lose much. Perhaps this is the wisdom behind the adage, endure to the end. So, no spiritual journey is a primrose path. It's a steep and thorny way to heaven, as Hamlet put it. The people you find at Sunstone are not the ones who have jumped. They are the ones who are still trying to navigate their vessels between the rocky shores of Charybdis and the teeth of Scylla. They are the ones who have been brave enough to plunge into their second act. But getting through the second act is not the end. As Elie Wiesel said just a few months ago, "I believe that what we receive, we must share. When I endure an experience," and you have to remember who's writing this, "the experience cannot stay with me alone. It must be opened. It must become an offering. It must be deepened and given and shared." "Undergo the journey," playwright David Mamet says. "That's why writing never gets any easier. Thus, I believe in Sunstone, because Sunstone is the place where we wrestle and the place where we share the stories of our struggle. Perhaps we're a small band of bards. Perhaps this our struggles and our stories will go for the most part unnoticed. But we will continue, because as the novelist E.M. Forrester wrote, one can, at all events, show one's own little light here, one's own poor little trembling flame, with the knowledge that it is not the only light that is shining in the darkness, and not the only one which the darkness does not comprehend." Thank you.
Pinches. "I believe never to allow anyone else to do my thinking for me. This was my father's law and was so deeply embedded in his soul that late in his life, shackled by dementia, he spoke the first sentence I'd heard from him in months, the first full sentence. And it was, 'I love you, but I'm angry with you. You are making decisions for me.' It was the last sentence I ever heard my father speak. I've learned that in addition to having better luck than my dad did to make this law, lots and lots of humility. That's not easy. I tend to like my ideas, but I must admit that virtually everything about which I must think has been generated first by someone else. The books I read, the art I enjoy, the talking heads who bombard me all fill my mind with thoughts that are not first my own. My dependence on the thoughts of others is nearly complete. Nearly. But my independent portion is to sift, to weigh, and to test, to determine whether to make that information or belief my own. On the edges, I may create. But if I, that's only if I do my job very, very well. But I cannot do it out of nothing. Then again, if God did not create out of nothing, I'm reasonably comfortable with that reality. My humility must extend far beyond my dependence on the world. However smart we seem to be, it's never smart enough. There's always someone smarter, and there's always about something which we're not very smart. Even the most brilliant, mythical, perfect thinker has only 24 hours in a day. And I find 24 hours a day quite inadequate. In fact, I've found 62 years quite inadequate. Because I know also that I know everything with very incomplete, even flawed information, I know my thinking must be, by definition, more or less flawed. So what to do about it? Well, further statements. So here are just two practical ideas I found very helpful in trying to live this dictum. I've come to believe firmly in dialogue, not just the journal I love, but in the tussle and enlightenment of the free exchange of ideas face to face. I enjoy the blogs, but I long to hear the tones. I long to see the expressions so that the words will have more meaning for me. So for 30 years, I've hosted unofficial firesides in my home, often author presentations and discussions. I've learned that much of the information I need, I don't yet know that I need. And much of that information will come first from others, and largely in conversation with them. Their ideas, their suggestions for reading, their critiques of what I'm thinking. I've also taught adults in church most of 40 years. Too often I see a baffling fear of ideas and of putting one's ideas out in the marketplace to be questioned, to be enhanced, qualified, rejected, or accepted. Ideas are personal attacks. And so I believe that as a teacher, I must add new information, play devil's advocate, and challenge conventional wisdom. All hopefully in a climate of safety for those willing to engage in. Even if I feel compelled to debunk a falsehood or challenge what appears on poor judgment, I've failed if I have not at least convinced the speaker. I'm grateful for their courage in putting forth an idea, and I'm hopeful they will continue to do so. My maiden name, the name in which I still dream, is McLellan. Our clan motto is Think On. I hope my father knows that proudly and humbly, I shall try to do so as long as I can.
In 1992, I moved from the religion of my childhood to the religion of my ancestors. But I would come to believe that jumping spokes was only a lateral move. All spokes are required to hold the wheel of religion intact with God at the center. But what if the wheel itself is unnecessary? What if the wheel has become destructive? Abandon religion. Giving up religion opens a space for me, and I believe for society, where enlightenment and meaning, unencumbered by dogma and division, can potentially emerge. Even though I have rejected the idea of a priesthood, for example, I believe that my recurring spontaneous blessings to my off-to-school grandson, in which I use the word Melchizedek, have become an expression of meaning and intimacy for both Josiah and me. I admit that giving up a religious system has robbed me of the... But when I was religious, belonging seemed to rely more on elevating the church to a higher place than it did on facilitating spiritual growth. At church, I never really got to decide who or what I was going to commune with, let alone serve. Despite having abandoned religion, I believe that its icons are an important cultural vein from which I mine the history, the sensibilities, the imagination, and the literature which I value. In short, religion's effects often play a vital part in the language of my emerging soul. Because they are utterly contingent upon my experience and my interpretation. Although it is time for me to abandon the cathedrals, the synagogues, the mosques, and the temples, perhaps once I do, I can then re-enter them as I enter my past, with appreciation, yes, but also with enough of a distance to be empowered rather than imprisoned by them. Most importantly, I believe one doesn't have to be religious to be a Mormon. I try to leave the shell of the church's dusty, poisonous imperatives behind, like Father Lehi did when he left Jerusalem. But on my head, the holy garment on my body, as a reminder of what I am rejecting, of what has been reinterpreted. And I aspire to gift the same time and money as I did before, but with greater commitment. I commit to my community, to the good of the collective, and to my God. Every time I am inspired to action, I am reminded of, in the parlance of Scripture, that, quote, faith without works is dead. unquote. Faith is better, I believe, without religion. The old hymns worthy of being sung because they hint at who I am and again give language to my emerging soul. I believe in giving claim our Mormonism.
You saved me.
I love seeing all the faces of so many loved ones. I believe I can create my life, and the creation occurs in each moment. I have not always been aware that I can create my life. I have usually thought that my life happened the way it happened, and I either enjoyed it or I put up with it. The creation I was aware of is that of taking materials in one form and creating them in another. It is a wonderful... This paper can be folded and created in this form. It can be interlocked and created in this form, which can move and shift and have dimension and change. But the physical object of creation is nothing. It is assembled, lost, burned, or flooded. The power is in the experience of creation. One of the greatest levels of creation for me is creating my life is acknowledging, hearing and seeing something that gives me life. My earliest memory, when I was about 2 or 3, I was in my crib. I was frightened or upset, and I was calling for my parents. I remember looking at a picture on the wall. It was very close, about eye level to me. It was of a woman sitting in a cave on a pile of hay holding a baby. She was surrounded by animals and people viewing the scene. I stared at the picture, and it seemed to become clearer and brighter to me. I was comforted. I laid down and went back to sleep. At that moment, I acknowledged a being in my life and the presence of great love that I later learned to call God. There was a moment a few years ago when I was watching a teacher talk about the power of language. He held up his hand and said, "It is language that tells us this is a hand, that this is a thumb, a space, a finger, a space. Language creates the hand and everything else." In that moment, I saw God being the Word, calling the world into existence by saying, "Let there be light," and there was light. And I acknowledged my own power to speak what my life is, and a new life began for me. There was a moment almost exactly 7 years ago today. I was in my parents' bedroom gathering with my siblings around Mom and Dad, holding Dad's hand, the last moment of his life. A figure of the purest matter. I acknowledge that the veil between this life and the next is only as solid as I allow it to be. A new life with my Dad began for me, for I know he lives in another plane, and there are moments when he is present here in this world. There was a moment last year on my birthday. I received a handmade card from my daughter Charlotte, who is on a mission in Kirtland Historic Sites. She had drawn a picture of the Johnson farmhouse with an arrow pointing to the room upstairs. And she wrote, "Be clever." I acknowledge that one of the greatest creations is love and at-one-ment. Eternal life is something that I can experience now. And this I believe, that God, our heavenly parents, created a physical life for us here so we could learn to practice our own power of creation. They did not create something to be manipulated or played with, torn apart or destroyed. They acknowledged us as creators in embryo and created an opportunity for us to try creating our lives and discover new life forever.
I'm in rehearsal. The actors are on break. I'm conferencing with my technical director. There's blood all over the floor and the throw rug between the armchairs and the card table and the frame of the door and splattered very lightly on the mirror. The TD and I are worried about that, and we have a bigger concern. Blood. Too much? Not enough? Just the right amount? I'm talking Lizzie. When Lizzie comes back in, third blackout. We're getting two little splotches in her arms. I want arterial. I want it dripping off her hands, I say. He nods, makes a note. It's a crucial moment in the play when the mean girl gets her comeuppance from the strange creatures haunting the fog-infested shelter house. Lizzie, the actress playing the role, certainly screams convincingly. She's the second best screamer in the cast. But I hope more blood will help sustain the illusion. Stage blood triggers something atavistic, something primal. The actor's intensity increases. Audience members lean forward in their chairs or giggle. But for this play, that's maybe all right. And Topher, you know, when he spits the blood up, he needs to spit straight up. So we get that little misting effect in the light, say maybe a two count. Then he should turn his head downstage, I say. And away from the armchair, says the TD, nodding again in a great Lake Arts Conservatory where they all study. I worried about writing for that age group. I don't know what it's like to be 17 anymore. And I worried about coming across as a pathetic old guy trying to be cool, writing characters who would say yo and what's up, dog, and faux shizzle or something equally lame. I also really, really, really don't want to preach, write some didactic tripe warning kids about the dangers of the internet or rock music or drugs or... I wanted to find somewhere we could genuinely, not artificially, connect. And then I thought, horror movies. I still have an adolescent love for fright and gore and terror, love the Saw movies, love The Orphanage and The Descent and The Grudge. So I wrote a scary play, an ooky, spooky, ghosty thing called Inversion, about campers caught in one of those nasty Utah fogs. It worked, the kids loved it, and we had a great time. In the rehearsal, I was able to open up the process, incorporate their ideas and insights and imaginations. But talking to colleagues about the play, I found myself downplaying it. It's just this little ghost thing, I'd say, for kids, and they'd laugh. It wasn't a serious play, after all, not art, not drama, not literature. Sure, Henry James wrote The Turn of the Screw, and 19th century literati and adored Poe, and Percy Shelley's sister wrote Frankenstein, but still, just horror. To make the whole thing messier, I kept saying, we're too much in control. Horrible things are happening. We'd all be losing it, wouldn't we? And the kids' acting began to move past technique and playing objectives and tactics into something more intensely felt. Opening night came and the audience, mostly parents, found the play amusing and fun. Heard the word cute a lot. Kids were disappointing. They were hoping to scare people, not be complimented on the excellence of their screaming. And we reviewed, a very puzzled review from a very astute critic who found levels of meaning I never intended or anticipated, which I found initially very flattering. Art is testimony. That's what I've always believed. That's why I find discussions of the morality of art so irritatingly irrelevant. Art is what happens when we say, this is what the world looks like from where I'm standing. This is what the world sounds like. This is how it's textured. This is what I imagine would happen if this were to happen first. And so in drama, film, and literature, we privilege either realism or work that's heavily abstract or subjective. We privilege serious art or seriously intentioned comedy. We even call it drama instead of a play, film instead of a movie, literature instead of a novel. Just creatures inhabiting fog, feeding off frightened hikers. I've never experienced that. This play isn't testimony for me. Or was it? Isn't the feeling of unreasoning terror fairly universal? Isn't fog pretty scary? No, where the play failed is that it didn't scare an audience of parents. Probably would have worked better with kids in the house, or maybe I just don't do horror very well. But I thought it was honest work, and not just because the cast and I genuinely connected in rehearsal. I thought it was good. Virtuous, lovely, of good report, praiseworthy, not just not harmful. I don't just mean it's Inversion, the play in production, didn't have a message, didn't teach a lesson, except perhaps if something's trying to eat you, do your best to escape it. But we sat in a room together and shared something human. That's all, and that's enough. Art can sometimes be poorly executed or incompetently presented, but art cannot harm, and doing art is good. All the time, always.
So complicated. All right. Nearly 20 years ago, I approached my bishop after a particularly unsatisfactory sacrament meeting and demanded that he let me speak in church the next Sunday. What'll you talk about? He asked. Humor, I said grimly. I want to talk about humor. The next week, I delivered the last church talk I ever gave, all about God's sense of humor, my conviction that he had to have one, even there was no mention of such a thing in the topical guide. If God could feel anger and love and approval and disappointment, surely he could feel amusement. Surely there was something not only healing but divine about a good laugh. Surely, I said, though I didn't feel sure at all, God wasn't some joyless authoritarian. Surely Isaac Dinesen got it right at the end of The Dreamers when she had a character declare, I have been trying for a long time to understand God. Now I have made friends with him. To love him truly, you must love change, and you must love a joke, these being the true inclinations of his heart. Wouldn't it be nice if God could laugh with us instead of merely at us in the superior way evoked by the joke? Know how to make God laugh? Tell him your plans. Try this. Close your eyes and call up a portrait of God the Father, perhaps a church-sanctioned depiction of him appearing to Joseph Smith, or even Michelangelo's painting of him animating Adam with a touch of his powerful finger. Now imagine that being throwing back his bearded head and laughing until he cries at Margaret Cho or Jackie Chan or Will Ferrell or Jon Stewart or who or whatever you find funniest. Is it even possible to imagine such a thing? Does it feel liberating, invigorating, irreverent, sacrilegious, ludicrous, scary, really easy because you've been doing it all your life? I no longer believe in a God with a personality, a divine superhero who punishes those who offend his ultra-fastidious sense of decency, so I don't have to imagine him doing much of it in this discussion and getting really pissed off at my flippant tone. But I continue to believe that the great mystery animating the universe has a sense of play and fun and cosmic irony. More and more, I want to talk humorously about important things, not from a simple desire to mock them, though I confess I find some things supremely deserving of mockery, but for the expanded, complicated, and even contradictory point of view that humor provides. I sometimes imagine that all of life and consciousness is a game or a joke, and wonder how it will all end. My greatest fear is that the joke's on us. The universe builds us an amazing home, and we wreck it. We denude and pollute it and crank up the heat until our beautiful garden is a fetid junk heap. That joke won't be funny. That punchline will be a punch we don't get up from. I pray there's a way in which humor can help us add a twist to the end of this story.
Son who gets to play on the varsity team by default. I've entitled my essay, The Forbidden Zone. I believe much of me developed because of science fiction. Heinlein, Asimov, Herbert, Clark, Card, and many others were on my reading menu for decades, and they still occupy space in my library. However, I believe film had the greater impact in my life. Star Wars was the coolest movie I had ever seen. Does one progress further by submission, in this case to the Force, or by self-reliance and a good blaster? And Star Trek, how can anyone not completely re-engineer their two-dimensional thinking after watching a wrathful Khan and a sly Kirk maneuver their way through the Motara Nebula? Another film that touched me in a way that I would not appreciate for 30 years after its release was Planet of the Apes, starring Charlton Heston as Taylor, a deep space astronaut who crash lands on a future planet run by intelligent and native two, I can only assume, non-tenured Professor Apes. Taylor escapes and enters an uninhabited, strictly off-limits area called the Forbidden Zone. And therein, he discovers the truth of this planet's history. I am captivated by the whole Forbidden Zone concept. Granted, the words Forbidden Zone might resonate like a youth conference topic referring perhaps to specific anatomy, or perhaps some potentially toxic act with loss of blessings or even eternal exaltation. Although valid at some level, that's not what I'm talking about. In Planet of the Apes, the Forbidden Zone was so designated by authoritarian types whose principal business, and it appeared that most of the ape citizenry were compliant and had no desire to enter therein, frightened as it were by Dante's imagined perils. But Taylor entered, and it transformed him. It was discovery, expansion, clarification, realization, and iconoclasm. And not unexpectedly, it was also pain and disillusionment. Additionally, recall Taylor and his woman riding at the end of the movie down the seashore. It was also gymnos, the Greek word for nakedness, from which we get gymnasium, where one learns best by shedding all pretense and preconception. I believe in the Forbidden Zone. It is an exquisite school and not toxic at all. And if it requires the purging of eternal exaltation thinking, so be it. In short, I believe it is the comfort and the ability to think freely, to shed the robes of fear, compliance, and judgment, and ask difficult questions, maybe about our traditional beliefs, our theology, our history, our future, our cosmology, our journey, and so much more. And the answers, call it what you will, but I believe it is freedom, it is release, it is passion and pure energy, it is agency, it is evolution and adventure, it is uninhibited discovery and learning. It is shaking off the chains of unbridled obedience. It is inner revolution, and it is paradoxically personal peace. And not unlike Taylor, I have my soul companion along for the ride.
Luckily for me, an important article of my personal faith was already eloquently spoken by the heroine of Middlemarch, who says, "I have a belief of my own, and it comforts me. It is that by desiring what is perfectly good and loving what is good and beautiful, we are part of the divine power against evil, widening the skirts of light and making the struggle with darkness narrower." I believe that in taking the material of our brute existence and striving to make it beautiful, we become participants in God's project of creating and recreating the world, giving existence richer substance and fuller meaning. New worlds are made in so many ways: painting, sculpting, singing, bricklaying, knitting, fiddling, quilting, running, every lovely thing human beings find to do. But there's one kind of world making I want to learn: the seemingly inexhaustible task and delight of choosing and ordering words as scaffolds for meaning. We create the world each time we speak. Every word destroys the world that existed before it was spoken, and all the worlds that might have been if we had chosen another word or silence. If God's work is to create embodied intelligences and then make them glorious and eternal, it's not so difficult to see how the word could undertake this project. Thoughts, feelings, the stuff of souls can be caught in fleeting perfect moments in words, and thus captured, persist long after the mind has changed or the body has died. Words memorialize and make eternal the glory of the soul's existence. And then, too, I believe that words are ultimately useless. Most of the meaning of our lives is deeper and truer than words can ever be. The mewing cry of a newborn, the toddler's laugh, the anguished howl of pain, the gasp of ecstasy, the taste of salt or coffee Heath Bar ice cream, the smell of bread baking, the stench of death and rot, the color of the sky before a tornado, the hollow ache of grief. For the heights and depths of human experience, words are poor approximations. Terrible things happen in the world, and no retelling of those stories can find an ending that is less than unbearable. Perhaps this is why the author of the Gospel of John named the one with the power to redeem every story the Word writ large, the light of the world that holds the power to make a new ending, to push back the skirts of darkness forever. The word believe, beloved, people and creatures and stories become true and beautiful when they are beloved. We can believe in and create beauty from ashes because we are beloved of one whose light cannot be comprehended by darkness. Or, in the words of E.E. Cummings, who, for all his exuberant sappiness, knew how to make worlds from scraps of language, love is the every only God who spoke this earth so glad and big. Even a thing all small and sad, man, may his mighty briefness dig, for love beginning means return. I believe in the beauty of this world, in the power of human language to create and partly capture that beauty, and I believe in the power of the Word that is God to tell all of our stories with the saving love that will make them whole and eternally, gloriously beautiful.
We should have ended with Christine's. I believe in the power of storytelling. Specifically, I believe that I have the ability to shape my relationship to the universe and insert beauty into my world through the life narrative I co-opt and create. Once upon a time, on a lovely spring morning, a young farm boy went into the woods to pray. He fought off the devil and spoke with shining heavenly personages. He returned a prophet. When I heard this story as a teen investigator, I was thrilled to insert myself into Joseph Smith's grand vision. My life had a beginning in God's presence as the child of a heavenly mother and father, a middle in the struggle of this mortal existence, a mission, getting married in the temple, bringing up children in the gospel. I was writing my way to a glorious conclusion. Then came a series of crises. Five little girls suffocated in the trunk of a car as a mother drove it through the neighborhood, praying desperately to find them. Tsunamis drowned and earthquakes crushed hundreds of thousands more. Random nature reigned and God retreated, tearing the pages of this story out of my hands. This story of an absent, deadbeat, heavenly dad dominated my life for several years. I can't remember whose death was involved. It might have been a relative or the body of an animal we discovered outside. All I know is that my little son and daughter had met death in one of its dark forms, and as their father, I had to shield them from the full force of that encounter. I was tempted to fall back on the old Mormon tale that we can live forever in God's presence with those who are dear to us, but it wasn't mine to tell anymore. When we die, our bodies return to the earth. All the bits decompose, feeding other life, which in turn feed other life. We are part of an ancient cycle of nourishment that has sustained countless generations of species upon this unique, life-rich planet. I continued telling them that the elements which make up our bodies, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and more, were formed in the furnaces of stellar forges, and that mighty supernovas scattered this life-bearing seed throughout the universe. Drawing inspiration from Carl Sagan, I told them that we were made of star stuff, and that long after we died, our material might return to the stars to burn brightly in someone's night sky. When I was done, my children sat with eyes wide and began peppering me with questions. Sometimes, when my own sense of mortality strikes, I remember this telling and feel that I am still part of a grand story full of wonder and glory, a tiny, insignificant part, to be sure. And the ending is perhaps messier and bleaker than some would like, but it's my story. And as I weave it into other narratives, it fills my life with beauty and purpose.
It definitely seems inappropriate to have a question and answer session here. What we'd prefer to do is for you to spend the last few minutes thinking about your own story, how you would write this, I believe, and then strongly encourage you to submit it to Sunstone for next year's panel, but I would like to make this a regular session. So we're coming around with some paper to hand out. We've got pens. Please stay and spend a few minutes thinking about your own this, I believe, stories.